Welcome to DevelopLex, a Middle Tech production hosted by me, Weston Lockhart, Ross Bogus, and Evan Knowles. This series will focus on the ins and outs of real estate development and investing, where we'll have the opportunity to sit down with developers of our cities, veterans of the industry, and key people that have over time made a massive impact on communities and neighborhoods. The purpose of this series is to be able to bring a knowledge base to our audience beyond that of what reading a book or watching a how-to video ever could, and educate from those who have done it by hearing their stories, both good and bad, along the way. We feel that historically the learnings of real estate have been inaccessible without being connected, and we would love to open the doors to the next generation of doers, as well as shine a light on how visions of community have been brought to life. We hope you enjoy. This episode is brought to you by Bank of the Bluegrass. It's easy to preach about being a community bank without actually operating that way, but I can attest as a real customer of Bank of the Bluegrass that they are truly in the community and for the community. Whether it's closing a real estate transaction that needs some creativity, troubleshooting an issue where you need a real person on the other end of the phone, or just the simple fact that when you walk in the door, your banker knows your name, Bank of the Bluegrass has you covered. Plain and simple, the best bank in town. Bank of the Bluegrass, member FDIC. NMLS 421548, Equal Housing Lender. DevelopLex is sponsored by SVN Stone Commercial Real Estate, a full-service commercial real estate firm located in Lexington, Kentucky, affiliated with the SVN International Network, which is comprised of over 1,600 advisors and staff and 200-plus offices across the globe. The SVN Stone team consists of experienced commercial real estate advisors in the heart of the Bluegrass. SVN provides commercial real estate services to large corporations, middle market businesses, and individual entrepreneurial investors. Serving the greater Lexington area, SVN offers advisory services for sales, leasing, management, and development of commercial properties locally, regionally, and nationally. With transaction volume of over $400 million, the advisors at SVN Stone Commercial Real Estate have vast experience and deep understanding of all aspects of commercial real estate.
Craftsman Contractors is Central Kentucky's one-stop shop for roofing, windows, siding, and gutters. CraftsmanContractors.com/contact us will get you straight to the form you need so that their team will get in touch about your project. Or just text Steven at 859-246-0108. When they finish your project of windows, siding, gutters, or roofing, you'll see what they mean when they say we build with integrity.
Welcome back to DevelopLex. Today, we are excited to have Tom Grinke with Bank of the Bluegrass on. We felt it very timely to have a lender and somebody in the finance world on the podcast to take a little bit of a different spin on things. Obviously, everything with Silicon Valley Bank, constantly talking about recession, although I don't know that we're under a definition of recession now that the definition's been changed. Interest rates, all of the things I feel like Tom can speak a lot to. I've always been told that Tom is one of the more creative bankers in town and just has a really good knowledge base of finance in general. We wanted to welcome Tom on today. So Tom, welcome on.
Weston, I appreciate it. Thanks so much for having me today. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah.
And before we get started, it is March 24th, 2023. This podcast will be released here very soon, but the information that we know true to be today may not be true come Monday. Things may change. So
true.
Big disclaimer on this that anything that we have opinions, that's just what we know today. So give us a couple days and we might have some new thoughts.
I also said, I forgot to mention, the reason we actually wanted to have Tom on is because Tom's a fortune teller, and he will accurately predict the future for sure. So that's good. No, Ross hit it on the nail, or the nail on the head. We're talking in, we're talking loosely about finance in the market right now, so nothing that we say will probably make sense or stick true in 6 months from today, but at least a speculation on what's going on today. So let's get into it a little bit. Let's introduce Tom, and then we can kind of go into everything going on. So Tom, where are you from? How'd you get to where you're at today? And what would you say you do today?
I appreciate it, Weston. I was born in Indiana and raised outside of Chicago. And my beautiful wife and I moved to Lexington in 1997. So in terms of where we're from, I think having been in Lexington for 25 years and raising three children, the oldest in college now, I'd say that we're Lexingtonians at this point. I know my kids feel that way. So we're happy to be part of the Lexington community. In terms of how I got here, I attended Indiana University in Bloomington, you know, go Hoosiers, earned a degree in finance. And then while I was working as a commercial lender in Lexington, attended University of Kentucky, go Cats, and earned the MBA. And that was, you know, back in the mid 2000s. So, in terms of, you know, how I got here, I guess I've always had an interest in finance, always had an interest in money. My mom told me that when I was about 5 years old, I told her I wanted to be Secretary of the Treasury. And I kind of held on to that for a few years, so I didn't quite make it that far, but happy to be here. In terms of describing myself, I would say that I'm a community banker in Lexington, Kentucky, and that I'm privileged to work with the absolute best group of folks in the country at Bank of the Bluegrass. That's what I would say.
So do you still want to be Jerome?
I think that'd be fine. Yeah, that'd be fine. I don't think anyone could do any worse, right? And we could get into the interest rate conversation, and maybe that's the segue. But, you know, Jerome Powell really waited, didn't he? You know, he kind of waited and waited and ended up with a heavy dose of inflation, which they decided to use their primary monetary tool to fight and started that fight back last March. And ended up with 400 basis points of rate increases in a 12-month period of time, which is unprecedented, truly. It's never happened in the history of our country, even back in the 1980s, when inflation was actually much higher than it is today. So yeah, Jerome is, he's in the hot seat, right? And now he's got quite a difficult balancing act, because as he raises interest rates, primarily the bonds and other investments, long-term investments that are held inside of banks' investment portfolios are losing value. So he continues to raise rates, and the value of those investments continues to decline. If they're sold, there's a loss. If they're held to maturity, no loss, right? And I think that's an important distinction and something that we can get into later if you'd like.
Yeah, I think it, to get as elementary as possible and then to get into what the Fed is doing right now to combat inflation, and then kind of the situation that we've been in for the last few weeks. Obviously, sure. Huge news with Silicon Valley Bank. But let's get into first, unless you want to segue a different way.
I would rather get into how banks work first. Mm. And so I think there's a lot of confusions that everybody pulling deposits out or things changing so quickly being within years for, say, SVB. Walk through how banks have money, are able to lend it out, how the cycle works for people that may not be able to peek inside how banks truly hold money, make money, and keep everything moving.
Sure, yeah. That's a great question, you know, and I think what it comes down to is that, you know, banks are financial intermediaries, right? And they solve the classic asset liability mismatch problem. People want to deposit short-term funds, and they want to have access to those short-term funds. But banks take that money that's very short-term in nature. So think about your checking account or your savings account, and they invest in things like loans in their community, or investments inside of their investment portfolio, which are primarily very highly rated, you know, A+ bonds, you know, government securities, that sort of thing. That's what banks do. So it's very different from a regular business, right? And when I say regular business, think of a distribution business or a manufacturing business. When they hold cash on their balance sheet, that's an asset for that particular type of business. When banks hold customer deposits, that's a liability on our balance sheet, because that's what we use to invest into loans in the community and or investments in our investment portfolio. So, you know, the real problem is that these liabilities, you know, are used to purchase and fund long-term assets. And when too many folks want to redeem those liabilities in too soon, too quickly, that creates a run, if you will, on the bank. And it's that classic lack of liquidity at the bank level created kind of the issues for Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank, which I wanted to bring up as well, since it's the second and third largest bank failure in the history of the United States of America within a two-day period of time. One failed on Friday, the next failed on Sunday, or was taken over by the FDIC on Sunday. So tremendous failures. But when you have too many depositors come in at the same time to redeem those liabilities off the bank's balance sheet, that's what creates the lack of liquidity and ultimately the failure at that level.
Gotcha. So you're telling me that if I deposit a bunch of money in your bank, you don't necessarily have every single dollar on hand from every depositor at all times. You go and then go and then loan those funds out.
That's right.
And that triggers what's called a bank run, is when people try so quickly to take those funds out. Is that correct? We've heard that term a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I'm really appreciative of the opportunity to share a little bit about how this has come about, because I've heard so many rumors, you know, in the marketplace and so many different opinions, and actually had people emailing me when it was happening about the investment portfolio, and that's why the bank in California failed. That's not why the bank in California failed. It's not why the bank in New York failed. Their investment portfolios were sound. They had really strong government securities inside their investment portfolio. Yes, would they have preferred to ladder that portfolio a little bit and probably have a higher yield inside that portfolio? Absolutely. But if you've got a 2 or 2.5% government obligation, bond or T-bill, within your investment portfolio, that's a pretty sound investment. The real issue came about, and I guess we can just dive right into Silicon Valley Bank, because it's the second largest bank failure behind Washington Mutual in the history of our country. And I don't think too many people saw it coming. The FDIC, I think, saw there was risk. But as far as the average folks, people in Lexington going on about their day and their business, they probably didn't see it coming. But the major issue with Silicon Valley Bank was their growth and their concentration inside that deposit portfolio. And I want to touch on this probably more than once, because it's one of the bigger points I think that we can make. About 90% of their depositors were not FDIC insured at Silicon Valley Bank. I think it was like 89.7%. So I want to say it again, 90% of their depositors were not FDIC insured. The reason why that matters is because when people become worried about the liquidity of a bank, what they're really worried about is losing their money because it's not FDIC insured, right? So when you have 90% of your depositors that are not FDIC insured, that becomes a major problem. And the reason why they had 90% of their depositors that were not FDIC insured is because the bank grew from, I have notes, $50 billion in 2019 to $200 billion in 2022. Now think about it. It's a bank, right? Banks probably should grow somewhere in the 5 to 10% range if they're doing things in a conservative manner, if they're investing conservatively and loaning conservatively. This bank grew by $150 billion in a very short period of time, and most of that was tech and VC money. And when that tech and VC money that was not FDIC insured came to be at risk, a lot of people pulled it out at the same time, and that's what created the run, and that's why it happened so quickly.
And so when you say it's not FDIC insured, that's saying it's above the cap. Is it
correct?
Is it
$250,000 per tax ID number, essentially?
And so that's saying entity X, they got their $250,000 back, but everything else could poof away anytime.
Exactly. But the government did come in, right? So they stepped in, and this is a huge deal. And I know this leads into, you know, the latter half of this call, but the government stepped in and made all deposits good, right? They guaranteed all deposits. Theoretically, what would have happened is they would have just guaranteed those deposits, Ross, to your point, that were up to the $250,000 FDIC limit, and the rest were at risk. Now, in a typical bank failure, it's usually around 80 to 85% is that you get about a 15 to 20% haircut on your deposits if there's a bank fail, you know, bank failure. So it's not usually, it's not that you have a $50 million account and you walk away with $49,750, right? It's usually end up with, you know, $40 million or $42 million or somewhere in that range. But it is interesting, you know, you think about Silicon Valley Bank and that growth and that concentration with venture capital money and tech money, which was flowing freely, and they had a whole bunch of it on their balance sheet. And then they went out and purchased government securities, which again, the government securities in and of themselves did not cause the bank to fail, but they had these massive accounts on their balance sheet that were not FDIC insured. And so when that run came, it came quick. In the digital age, people don't have to walk to the bank to get their money out, right? So it happened fast. And that's why
it happened on a Sunday.
Well, Signature was Sunday. I think Silicon Valley was Friday. But your point is, I mean, that Sunday, that never happens, right? The FDIC doesn't take banks over on Sunday. That just doesn't happen. So very interesting.
And so I know Weston has more questions, but I'm just so intrigued. When they talk about bank investors, is that a group of people that came together in the early stages of it and said, hey, we can do banking a little bit better than the guy next door? The Wall Street Journal has said, like, well, investors get their money back here, but they were taking on a risk knowing. I didn't know. I was confused how banks even got started and if there were investors into banks or what those shareholders and banks are.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I mean, banks are public. Most of these banks are publicly traded. You know, the larger banks are publicly traded. So they've got equity, you know, they've got equity as a source. And that's one thing that Silicon Valley Bank tried to do was to try to issue more equity, sell some shares to raise capital. I think they had some debt financing as well. I'm not familiar with how much debt financing they had. But banks have capital requirements, right? So, you know, we're required to keep just on average 10%. You don't have to have that much. That would be a very well-capitalized bank at 10%. But, you know, and so Silicon Valley Bank was capitalized, you know, appropriately. I think what it comes down to is this concentration issue. And it's interesting to me, you know, as a community banker, because when I look at our bank, at Bank of the Bluegrass, and I would say it's very similar for most of the banks in Lexington, the community banks, the vast majority of our deposits are FDIC insured. We have clients that obviously have more than the FDIC insurance limit, but there are programs available through IntraFi, which offers this ICS product, which allows basically depositors to be insured up to $70 million at any single financial institution that qualifies. So when you look at a bank like Bank of the Bluegrass, or I would even say, you know, Central, Traditional, really any of the kind of the community banks in town, you know, their deposits are very granular. They've got a whole bunch of relatively small accounts. They don't have accounts that have $50, $60, and $70 million in them. They have a lot of $10,000, you know, dollar accounts and $100,000 accounts. So it's a very granular customer base, and it's very well insured in terms of the FDIC coverage limit. So people didn't really panic, you know, at the community bank level. As a matter of fact, most community bankers, I think I've got an article from S&P Global this morning that said that the vast majority of community bankers are actually seeing an increase in their overall deposits as a result of everything that's been happening. And I think they're seen as a safe haven because they're a little bit more conservative by nature than SVB or Signature Bank.
Are you looking to start or scale your real estate portfolio in Central Kentucky? Check out Rapid Fire Investments. They find off-market discounted real estate deals just for you. so you can save time and maximize profits. From single-family homes to multifamily apartments, no matter what your investment goals are, Rapid Fire can help you reach them. Sign up for their email list today and get notified when new properties become available. Just go to rapidfireinvestments.com. That's rapidfireinvestments.com.
I have so many follow-up questions, but I'm not going to make everybody listen to them. I think the most important one to me is to talk about the ramifications, but I also want to take a step back and look into why is the Fed raising rates in general? Why are we continuing to go up for the last however many months? What is the purpose of that? Just an elementary question.
No, I mean, it's inflation. You know, Weston, the Fed's number one priority in everything that they do, which is vast, everything that they do, their number one goal is to fight inflation, and their target is 2%, right? And we've been upwards of 6.5% for the last few months. I think it finally dipped to, 6.4 or something like that in February. But we've been significantly over their target, and they've made it very, very clear that it remains their target. So the pain that it might cause, think about something like unemployment, which some might argue unemployment's a little too low right now in terms of finding people to work and that sort of thing. But they will cause pain before they give up on their inflation target goal. That is their number one goal, and that's why they raise interest rates. So they do it by increasing the Fed funds rate, right, or Fed funds rate target, and that essentially increases the cost to borrow. So it discourages people from borrowing money and encourages people to save money, right? When's the last time we've seen 4% CDs or 4.5% CDs? It's been a while, right? It's been early in my bank career. I saw them, but that was 20 years ago. And so for those savers, it's a good time, right? And there's the yield on bonds right now is excellent. You know, treasuries, it's outstanding. So it's probably the best that it's been. But, you know, just to make the point again, they've raised 400 basis points over the last 12 months. And that's completely unprecedented. So that rapid rise, obviously they're very concerned about inflation. If the goal is to get inflation down, they're going to have to keep going up with interest rates. And now prime is at 8%, which I haven't seen for, you know, again, quite a while, probably close to 20 years, you know, in my banking career. So those projects that looked really, really good at 3.5% or 4%, they don't look so great at 8%. You know, the returns aren't as good at 8% as they were at 3.5%. So just by definition, there's going to be a constraint there. Just from a project level, there's going to be some constraint there. But I did want to back up. This was interesting. I did a little bit of research in anticipation of the call. So I pulled up the total banking assets. I have a question for you all. I pulled up the total banking assets of all state chartered banks in the state of Kentucky. So just every bank in the state that's chartered in the state of Kentucky, what do you think the total assets of that of this group of banks, which Bank of the Bluegrass is a part of, the entire group of banks, what do you think our total asset base is?
I thought you were going to ask me how much money I have in my account. Was what the question I thought you were going to ask me. So
he's a magician.
So yeah, I started trying to think through that. No, I'm just going to take a wild stab and say, I mean, it's going to be so wrong, Tom. I'm going to say $20 billion.
Okay, well, Signature Bank or SVB was $200 billion plus, right?
So I thought you were tricking me.
No,
that was the
you're
direction.
On the right track. You're actually on the right track, okay? So what's
let's go $200 billion. I'm going to make it crazy.
So just know that if he guesses right, that's because of my guess.
Price is right. I win a car.
You know, here's the crazy part. Weston is actually closer than you are, Ross. It's about $75 billion. So the reason I wanted to share that is because the scale of these failures, right? So Silicon Valley Bank was over $200 billion. Signature Bank in New York was over $100 billion. All of the assets of the state charter banks in the state of Kentucky, $75 billion. So wow. When we get to the ramifications and we talk about moral hazard and all of those things, to put it in perspective, you know, these are huge failures, you know, and should we have seen them coming in terms of, you know, in industries, you know, I know that back in, I read articles back in 2015, 2016, that FDIC was concerned about the deposit concentration at Silicon Valley Bank. But nothing really happened to them until now. And then, of course, the bailout, if you will, because all the depositors were made whole. So what does that do to the system, you know, if you will? Silicon Valley Bank, $200 billion and Signature Bank. And Signature Bank was interesting. Again, when you talk about the deposit side and the deposit concentration, Signature Bank had about 27% of their total deposits with digital currency or crypto exchange companies. So, right. So let's say that Weston owns a crypto exchange company, and in on his balance sheet, he's holding cash, right? So Weston at one point has $10 million. Crypto blows up. He's up to $100 million. Well, Signature Bank had that on their balance sheet. So they took that money and, again, lent it out, you know, real estate loans, or bought long-term assets inside of their investment portfolio. And it's kind of the same thing. 27% of your customers in a very volatile industry that blew up, and you were loving life along the way, you know, as it rose and rose and rose, you put that money into your investment portfolio and made money on it. But with that type of concentration, once Silicon Valley Bank failed, or there were rumors that it was going to fail, and who knows, again, too, is how quickly that news traveled, right? Social media wasn't around back in the 1930s. So, you know, here we are, Signature Bank, you know, the depositors at Signature Bank that had, you know, accounts over $250,000 said, oh, I need to get my money out too. And again, we're back to the liquidity piece where essentially, you know, the bank is holding those deposits as liabilities and clients can come pick those up or redeem those at any one time. You have too many clients redeem them at any one time, the bank is going to fail. You know, it just is. Now, there are resources that banks tap into. There's Fed funds lines and there's the Federal Home Loan Bank. There's a lot of access to liquidity that banks have. But in this case, the numbers were so staggeringly large that they just couldn't recover fast enough. You know, there wasn't enough time to recover.
So could you bridge the gap between Fed raises interest rates and then are banks in Lexington able to buy that directly from the Fed? Are there intermediaries there before it gets to a bank client? Consumer. Or what?
No, it's,
what's
yeah, it's
what's the process the of that's awesome.
Second,
directly from
second,
the Fed.
I have a second ramification follow up, Tom.
Sure.
If and this may be more of an opinion, so I'm not sure. But is what happened to Silicon Valley Bank? You said that, and this is not you just saying this. This is what the Fed is trying to do is cause pain to a certain extent with the economy. Inflation has to chill out. Is that not pain to have a bank fail the way that it did? And with that, obviously, they said that all of the people that were hurt, I mean, that were deposit holders at the bank or that were clients of the bank that were over that $250,000, they're gonna be okay, provided they're mm-hmm. not investors in the bank or on the board or whatever. Is that counterintuitive to what the Fed is trying to create? Did it happen too fast? Like, what are the ramifications of the Fed insuring all those funds over $250,000?
Well, that's a great question, you know, and that's a very tough question to answer. The immediate ramification, and I'll just kind of go back in time, you know, the FDIC was created by FDR back in, I don't know, 1933, I think, or thereabouts, to really stop bank runs, right? So the government basically said, okay, we're going to create an insurance fund, and it is truly an insurance fund, and it's going to be held at the government level, and we're going to be in charge of it, and we're going to basically guarantee anyone's deposits under $250,000. Well, so how does that insurance fund work? Who funds the insurance fund, right? There has to be a pool of money out there so that when a bank fails, they pull from the insurance fund to cover that failure. So who pays into that? You know, we do, right? Bank of the Bluegrass does. Every bank in Kentucky pays into it, right? And guess what's going to happen to our cost to do business in terms of paying into that insurance fund, right? So the next phase is we're going to get a special assessment. I have no idea how large that special assessment is going to be, but I expect it to be, not palatable. And ultimately, our cost of doing business is going to go up as a community bank, which means that we'll probably have to pass some of those costs to consumers. But I think the long-winded way of saying is it's going to kind of ripple through the economy, and everyone is going to pay for these bank failures in one way or another. Whether you get charged an extra quarter point on your loan, or you get charged $10 to have your checking account, or whatever it is, whatever the mechanism is that the bank decides to employ to essentially recover that extra money that they're going to have to put into the deposit insurance fund, it's going to get passed through, to consumers. So, and then you talk about a little bit the moral hazard. There's been some debate out there, should the government have let these banks fail? What type of moral hazard situation are you creating when you allow a bank to take these types of risks, i.e. deposit concentration risk, industry risk, and then walk away scot-free? Now, I don't think the CEO of these banks and some of the board members, they're probably not going to walk away scot-free, but certainly, bailing these banks out is something that we'll look at over the next 5 to 10 years and try to figure out if it was the right decision or not. I don't know if anyone knows the answer to that today.
I'll credit you with the quote too, and I'll probably stop crediting you and rip it as my own at some point. But I believe that you were the one who told me that it's an interesting new. No, it wasn't you. I'm sorry, Tom. This is a quote I heard.
A friend. I'll take it. Wait. I might take it. Go ahead.
All right, it's Tom's now. The ramification that they said of if you didn't insure the people, or if the people that had more than $250,000 in their accounts did not get that money back, and it did cause just an economic shift towards larger banks or whatever that might be, or distrust in the system, the ramification become, well, you just can't expect consumers like myself that doesn't have $250,000 at my bank, or that does have $300,000 in my bank, to underwrite every single bank that they ever put money into and look at the way that they are investing that money. Is that a fair point to make?
I think so. Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think it's tough. I mean, I can tell you by law, banks are not allowed to publish or even discuss their FDIC rating, right? So every period of time, and we just finished our exam at the at Bank of the Bluegrass, and they come in, they look at capital, assets, management, earnings, liquidity, and a host of other things, and then they give you a rating. But those ratings aren't published. So it would be really easy for people to look at those ratings and say, oh, that's a bank I think, I want to bank with. They've got an excellent rating. But again, those aren't published. So then it comes down to people trying to understand the financial strength of the institution with which they're banking. And I don't know that a lot of people know how to read, a bank balance sheet, really. I probably didn't before I got into the industry, and I consider myself a fairly savvy financial guy, but it's kind of a different industry. And so I think asking people to try to determine whether their bank is safe or not from a financial standpoint is really challenging, because they just don't have the tools to do that. But yeah, I would agree. And again, the folks under 250, which is the preponderance of clients at a community bank like ours, they need not worry. Because they're totally FDIC insured. What we're talking about with Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank are those depositors that had $30, $40, $50 million in one account. Would that have led to contagion? you know, I don't know, maybe. So maybe it's a good thing that they bailed those depositors out just to kind of ease the system and make sure that there was enough liquidity out there, because that was really one of the mistakes that the country made years and years and decades ago, really, is really not providing liquidity. And I think the Federal Reserve understands that. So they're going to do everything they can to provide the requisite amount of liquidity to keep everything moving.
Gotcha.
So, so bringing it back home to Kentucky, Lexington, as we go through the next couple years where there is going to be friction as we're trying to regain the inflation, trust in dollar, or balance how the trust is put into the dollar, things like that. What are things that would be expected in any sort of period as we're getting into something like a 6% is a good percent, good interest rate kind of thing? What do you see from your experience that people should expect?
In terms of interest rates, Ross, or okay.
Yeah.
I mean, we talked about this a little bit at the outset or prior to the recording. You know, obviously it's very difficult to predict interest rates. It's been a very noticeable change. You know, Weston's got his 2.5% mortgage, and Ross, you know, you're probably sub 3%, and now mortgage rates are over 6%. You know, I don't know for sure, right? But here's what I do know is that the 10-year Treasury and the 2-year Treasury curve are, you know, they're really out of whack. When you look at it, the yield on the 2 years higher than the yield on the 10-year, which tells me that bond buyers that are going that far out on the 10-year curve are saying, we don't really think inflation's gonna be that big of a deal, and we think interest rates are gonna have settled out because we're only willing to pay X for this 10-year bond, and it's actually lower than what people are paying for the 2-year. So when you look at kind of the inverted yield curve, you look at the fact that the 2-year and the 10-year are that far apart, with the 10-year that far below the 2-year, it's got to tell you that rates are going to start to come down. I check the Fed funds futures market almost daily. I would encourage folks who are interested in interest rates to do the same. They trade at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. And, you know, the last time I checked them, you know, I'm out of town right now, but the last time I checked them, it looked like rates were going to start to come down prior to the end of the year, right? So don't know that for sure. And that, you know, no one knows for sure what interest rates are going to do. But the reason I like to look at the Fed funds futures is because the futures contract, you know, has unlimited gain, but also unlimited loss. So people who are investing in those, you know, it's not an option, right? You can't just walk away and say, oh, I choose not to exercise. It's a futures contract. It's a zero-sum contract. If Weston makes $100 million on his contract and I've got the other end, I just lost $100 million. So people are putting their money where their mouth is, and they're saying that they think rates are going to come down by probably somewhere between 75 and 100 basis points by this time next year, right? So take that with a grain of salt. I wish I knew the answer to the interest rate question. What I would say is, if you're a saver, it's a good time to go buy a CD or a, you know, put your money in a money market account at the bank. You know, I would say that. If you're a borrower, I'd say, you know, borrow judiciously and don't expect rates to be to fall anytime in the near future. Because again, I mean, we're looking at 8% for prime, Wall Street Journal prime, which, you know, that's kind of been the challenge, I think, is people who have been caught in the middle, if you will. Is, you know, there's people who have variable rate products like a home equity line or a construction loan, and those products have gone from, you know, 4 to 8 in a 12-month period of time. You know, their payment has doubled, you know, on an interest-only payment. So if your payment was $500 or $600 a month, now it's $1,000 or $1,200 a month. And of course, that's what the Fed wants, right? They want people to feel the pain of interest expense so that they don't have that money to spend on other things, kind of diminish demand and get inflation back down to their target of 2%. But yeah, in terms of expectations, I'd say, you know, hang in there. And hopefully, if the Fed funds, you know, futures curve is accurate, rates will start coming down, you know, somewhere between 75 and 100 basis points by this time next year.
Perfect synopsis. Yeah, I mean, everybody in some capacity, whether they own a home or whether they're a customer of a bank and don't just have a bunch of cash laying around their house, needs to know this kind of stuff. And I know that everybody's interested. So we wanted to hit on a few of these things in kind of a short time frame. So we appreciate you making time to come on, Tom. That was awesome.
Absolutely. You know, Weston, Ross, really very much enjoy the podcast, right? Enjoy what you guys are doing. I think it's great for Lexington, and I'm just, you know, honored to have been invited to participate. Okay.
Awesome. Bank of the Bluegrass.
Thanks, Tom.
Yeah, we appreciate you all.